Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Ocean view, land by the sea, coastal condominium, beachfront home. For many Americans, the idea of life by the sea is so romantic, so attractive, that at latest count, half the people in this country have already moved to one of its coastlines. Half. The problem is that the very feature which lures so many to the seashore is also what's suffering the most from all that attention, the ocean itself. You see, every new roof, every driveway, ditch, and road steals away the land that the ocean depends on to clean its own water. And it's not just the coast lovers who are to blame here. Even people living way inland have their hand in that mess with their sacks of lawn fertilizer and municipal wastes. As the U.S. turns its attention to something called a new ocean policy, it's also becoming much clearer now just how sick the world's saltwater really is and how vital the oceans are to the health of the planet and its inhabitants. Scientists are now warning that keeping the oceans clean will require more than government policy. It will take individual choices. So, Connection listeners, what would you do to save the ocean? Would you be willing to stop eating seafood? Or say no to that vacation home on the beach? Or that perfect green chem lawn, if it all meant a cleaner sea? 1-800-423-TALK is our number, 1-800-423-8255. Joining me in the studio today is Deborah Kramer. She writes about science, nature, and the environment. She's the author of Great Waters, An Atlantic Passage. And joining us from her home in Bluffton, South Carolina, is Nancy Schilling. She's the founder of Friends of the Rivers, an organization dedicated to preserving the water quality of the South Carolina Lowcountry. Welcome to both of you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Nancy, let me start with you. This decision to found the Friends of the Rivers, this was something that you decided to do only a couple of years ago, is that right?
It was just 3 years ago.
Okay.
And it was based upon my opportunity to see what an environmental impact study is that gets passed from a developer through a consulting firm to an agency and goes and sits on a shelf, and what the people don't know needs to be protected in the meantime.
Now, you were setting out to protect a river which was already clean. Am I right?
Well, in fact, what we do, we call it Friends of the Rivers because we're interested in all the river systems of Beaufort County, South Carolina, which includes Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. And in the past 7 years, in 1995, it was concluded that 200 acres of open shellfish beds needed to be closed because they were unhealthy. So,
what was causing the problem?
Well, it turns out to be non-point source pollution. We don't have any direct discharges from industry here, but what we do have are a lot of homes. And as you said in your introduction, you know, every home, every paved driveway, every roadway makes a difference. So the Sea Pines community was started back in the 60s, and Hilton Head just boomed after that. So in 1995, when they have to close all the shellfish beds, then all of a sudden the impacts of development on this barrier island had obviously taken their toll.
Now, this is one of the wealthiest parts of this country, the people living there, right?
Well, I guess upper middle class, you would call it.
I'm just wondering whether or not that made it or would make it any easier for you to say, hey, folks, got to fix this and get people's attention.
Well, not even that. It's just to know how you as an individual impacted. And what they found were these non-point sources of pollutants are things like fertilizers, faulty septic tanks, domestic pet waste, as well as roadways. So things that individuals can do something about.
Deborah, is this something that you can look at from your own home in Gloucester on the northeast coast?
Of course you can see it there. I live on a tidal estuary where there are many, many shellfish beds. And when I first moved to Gloucester 20 years ago, the shellfish beds were open all the time. Soon they were closed after an inch of rain. Then they were closed after half an inch of rain, then after a quarter of an inch of rain, and now a lot of them are closed all the time.
So rain means runoff, means waste from the land, means poisoning the shellfish beds. Is that why you make the connection to the rain and the closure of the beds?
Rain brings runoff from land. The more houses there are,
right,
the more impervious surface there is, the more water runs into the sea, and that water has sediment in it, it has fertilizers from lawns, it has pesticides, and it has contaminants from faulty septic systems.
Let me take just one really small example. If I build a house by the ocean and I put in a driveway and I pave that driveway, you're saying to me that that's something of a substantial problem. What am I really changing by just covering up that one little patch of dirt where I want to park my car?
Well, there's 16 times more runoff off an acre of paved land.
So the water just goes back into the ocean faster?
Off a meadow. It just goes in faster, but by going in faster, it causes a lot of erosion. Erosion destroys marshes, which help filter water and keep it clean. In addition, what's in the water rushes, the rainwater rushes directly into the sea rather than soaking into the ground. So that some kinds of contaminants will dissipate if they can go into the ground first, but instead they're going directly into the water.
And Nancy, in your own work in South Carolina, how do you get this message across? Because it's not the, you know, it's not the oil spill, it's not the great ugly pipe of municipal waste that we normally point to. We're talking about very, very subtle things here.
Well, the subtlety that we use is the oyster as the natural indicator of water quality. And you can say it very directly. A sick river causes sick oysters, which is sick people. So you hit people in their stomach and you say, you know, you need to be concerned about this. Fortunately, in South Carolina at this point, we have 65% of our oyster beds open for harvesting. And over 85% of them are open in our low country region down here in our area. But the indicator on Hilton Head was closing Broad Creek completely for harvesting in 1995 was enough of a wake-up to let people know that we need to be concerned not only since then but into the future with better stormwater design and management.
I was reading a long, long feature in the New York Times a couple of weeks back about work that's being done to clean up Long Island Sound. Do you have any idea, Nancy, whether or not the types of proposals that you've been trying to put in place just over the last 3 years have had or can make a difference?
Oh, most definitely. You know, the Chesapeake Bay is starting to revive, as is Long Island Sound. What I would propose is even if it isn't a requirement of a community, that a good developer putting in, well, and our area is seeing so much growth, it's not old, you know, bad habits, it's new growth that can be our downfall. But a good developer will design to the highest levels of pollutant removal and not just old best management practices and what's just required. So that's what we're hoping for here is that higher level of development.
And Deborah Kramer, you know the pace at which the Northeast Coast is being developed, the demand for land is almost frightening. Do you look at that as something that the states, the federal government, the municipalities really need to focus on as something that can help the health of the ocean?
Of course, states, municipalities, and the federal government need to focus on this. This is why we have the Pew report coming out right now, why we're going to have a national U.S. Ocean Commission report coming out in the fall. But we have a number of studies already that show that our oceans are in serious trouble. And so it's all going to be individuals working what they do in their homes, in groups, in their communities, and then on a larger scale, making our government do what it needs to do.
Do we have to be frightened into making those sorts of individual choices? I know that you get a little bit tired of all the studies that tell us, you know, only 1.3 years left and then X and so on and so forth. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I don't know if it's a matter of being frightened because the data to frighten us has actually been out there for a while. I mean, 90% of our fish are gone. How many more?
90% of our fish are gone?
Yes, that was the latest study that was in Nature magazine, that we have removed 90% of the large fish from the North Atlantic.
And that's just since World War II.
Right.
So, our lifetime.
So how many more numbers do we need before we're frightened? What I tend to think is that Americans, and we do have the best environmental protection laws pretty much around, tend to walk up to the precipice and they're just about to jump off, and then perhaps we'll do something. I think the issue is just a little bit different. It's really, really difficult for us to appreciate the seriousness of these numbers. It's really difficult for us to understand why we have a problem because you can't always see it. And I think a perfect example of this is I used to spend a lot of time on the Chesapeake Bay, and we used to go down every afternoon and stick our little chicken necks in the water, and, you know, multiple blue crabs would come up on the chicken necks, and we'd have these fabulous dinners night after night after night. And I thought the Chesapeake Bay was beautiful, and it was sick, and I couldn't see it from where I was. And that is a large problem for all of us looking at the sea. We love it. I think one of the best examples of that is, you know, if you read Moby Dick, it's one of the greatest sea stories in the world. And in the opening paragraphs, Ishmael goes down to the water and he says, whenever I find myself grim around the mouth, or it's a damp and drizzly November in my soul, I go down to the water. The water means so much to us, and we just can't see what's happening to it. We stand at the edge, we can't see the other side. We look through, it's dark, we can't see the bottom. So we think it's vast and limitless, and really, it's kind of like a large pond. And the sooner we sort of reconceive our ideas about the sea, I think the better we'll be able to understand what to do. We think everything goes out on the tide, and it does, but it washes in someplace else.
Nancy, are people starting to see the whole picture in your view now?
Yes, and to add to what Deborah said, we call it loving it to death. What we are trying to do is educate people what they should expect, what they should understand. And in the Lowcountry, we are in the Atlantic Bight, which is an indentation almost to the East Atlantic coast. And so we are a significant nutrient provider to the Atlantic Gulf Stream. When our marsh grasses break down, they become food, they go into the creeks, they get washed out on our 8-foot tide, and they feed the Gulf Stream. We have dark rivers here, brown rivers, whereas after the Gulf Stream goes through its cycle in the Caribbean, it's clear. So we need to be careful about what we're doing right here.
Nancy, thanks a lot for being with us on the program today.
I appreciate it.
Nancy Schilling is founder of Friends of the River, Spring Island, South Carolina. That's an organization dedicated to providing water quality education and information to residents of the South Carolina Lowcountry. Connection listeners, we'd like to hear your stories, your thoughts about the way that we regard the oceans. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The FBI today began draining a pond in the woods near Frederick, Maryland.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest in the studio, Deborah Kramer, author of a new book, Great Waters and Atlantic Passage. Deborah writes about science, nature, and the environment. And when you wrote that book about your time on the Atlantic, you dropped the. What's that all about?
Well, I did do that. That was actually really interesting and long decision. I started writing the book about the Atlantic.
Right.
And I got about halfway through all the research and a lot of the writing, and my whole ideas about the Atlantic changed. I didn't see it anymore as an object out there. I saw it as a living, breathing organism. And so because I was getting really close to my deadline, I stopped writing in longhand and rewriting all the edits in longhand and switched to a computer. So search and find worked pretty well. And I went through all the references and I eliminated the. And then, because that to me reflected...
So use it for me in a sentence now, the way you would describe this ocean. You say...
I would just drop the article and refer to the sea as Atlantic.
I live on Atlantic Ocean?
Yes, yes. And I...
And it gets you a little bit closer, does it, then?
I think it does. It to me, it suggests that this is a living, breathing organism. It's not a thing out there. I was a little worried doing that because it took me... 5 years and half the book, you know, before I came to that conclusion, and I was really afraid. I didn't know what would happen when I put it out there, and it's been a real, I would say, mixed reaction. Some people are like me. They start off, it's very off-putting at the beginning, and then by the time they get halfway through the book, they understand what I'm doing, and other people understand right away, and other people get to the end and find it distracting.
Let's head south here, south in Atlantic Ocean. I got it. Around
Thanks.
Into the Gulf of Mexico, a couple of islands that yeah. you visited many times as part of a trip down to see in-laws in Florida, Sanibel and Captiva. A lot of people know them historically for their great shelling. And
the shells are beautiful. The water's warm. The sand is gorgeous.
Your last trip there wasn't exactly a successful one. Tell me about what you saw.
It was a little disappointing. We... came down for a special vacation, and we checked into where we were staying and immediately went out onto the beach. And I would say within a minute of being on the beach, we all began to choke. And there were long lines of fish, large fish.
Dead fish.
Dead fish washed up on the beach. And some of my family immediately retreated. I put a bandana around my face and kept walking. The line of fish just went on and on and on. And every time the waves broke, the air became more difficult to breathe. And it was a red tide.
What does that mean, Debra?
It was a bloom of marine plants that had gone haywire. And as the waves were breaking on the... you know, the tiny plants, these irritants were being shot up into the air. And obviously they'd poisoned a lot of the fish.
This sort of bloom that you're describing is when an inordinate amount of one particular kind of nutrient appears.
It's like putting too much fertilizer on a garden. It goes crazy. And some of the plants become toxic. That's one thing that happens. So that and you're probably more familiar with it up here. A red tide causes the closing of a shellfish bed, and then you can't eat any clams. The other thing but it's caused often by an excess amount of nitrogen in the water.
Can you connect this, Debra, to what you write about in a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico? That, to me, was, I think, one of the more sobering features of your look at the health of the oceans.
I was really surprised when I learned about that, and I was really sad. And what happens is there's a huge swath of the floor of the Gulf of Mexico that every summer dies. The mobile organisms that live there, fish, some crabs, can crawl away when there's no more oxygen, but everything that can't move dies. And the reason these animals die is because they have no air. They have no air because of all of the plants blooming at the top sink to the bottom, and as they decompose, they use up all the air. So there are too many plants at the top. Why is that happening? Because there's so much more nitrogen from fertilizer and sewage treatment plants coming down the Mississippi River.
So the responsibility for this goes all the way up to the Canadian border, essentially.
It basically goes into the entire drainage basin of the Mississippi River, which is 40% of the continental land mass of the United States.
And can you give us some kind of scale of this dead zone, how big it is?
Well, first of all, I guess I'd like to say it's been happening for 25 years. If this had happened on land, we might have responded a little faster, but it goes back to what I was saying before, we can't see it. Last summer, it was the size of the state of Massachusetts.
Unbelievable. But I was reading some of what you wrote, some of what's in the Pew Commission report, actually this weekend, sitting on the top deck of a ferry looking out over Nantucket Sound. Mm. So I had that wonderful opportunity to sort of read a paragraph and then look up, and then look down and read another paragraph and look up. And I found myself doing exactly what you said we need to get over, and that is somehow passing this mythic sense that the ocean is so big that anything that ends up in it is eventually going to disappear. I mean, I know fishermen, I know boaters who have just thrown stuff overboard because they see this vast ocean and they believe it is vast. You're saying it's not?
Well, I'm saying it's more like a large pond, and sooner or later we will need to come to face that. And there are real reasons why we need to disabuse ourselves of this romantic, and I mean it with a capital R, tradition, which has really governed the way we look at a lot of our natural resources and have for so many years. And I think the reason we need to forget about the idea that the ocean will take everything, all the garbage we put into it, away is because we need this ocean, and we need it badly. And I think, you know, it's amazing that it's 40 years ago, I guess, that John Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And we've forgotten everything that the sea gives to us. It brought us here. Life began in the ocean. The first act of, I guess, planetary pollution would be the creation of an atmosphere full of oxygen. That was given to us by plants in the sea. And today, conservative estimates are that at least 50% of the air we breathe comes from plants in the sea that we can neither name nor describe. We don't want to keep warming our waters because those plants will not be able to live in warm water.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll take our first call now from Saugus, Maine, and Tom's joining us. Hi, Tom.
Well, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. Great topic.
Oh, from Massachusetts.
I just wanted to give you my perspective. I've been scuba diving for almost 30 years now, and most of my diving is probably along the coast between Lynn, Massachusetts, and Rockport, Massachusetts. And when I first started diving back in the early 70s. I used to frequently, you know, come up with 3-4 pound lobsters and take them home and have a delicious meal, or I'd do some spear fishing and get myself, you know, a good 2-4 pound flounders. I mean, very, very large flounders that were absolutely delicious. Saw tons of fish, and had a wonderful time. And during the years, I've been noticing around this area that, the flounder are basically gone. Those that I do see are so small. The amount of lobsters that are of legal size has been reduced, and it's at the point now where I've actually stopped any kind of taking anything from the ocean because it's not worth taking the lobster. It's not worth going, you know, it's mostly now what I do is I just, you know, dive for recreation and just the enjoyment of being there. And in diving within probably most of the dives that I've made are within a mile of the coast, the amount of trash that I see in the ocean is almost comparable to, you know, going to a community where they, you know, spend a lot of time street cleaning or whatever, to a community that doesn't and just clean. I mean, it's literally littered all over the ocean floor.
What? What are you seeing down there, Tom?
Bags of Cheetos, you know, things like that. And I think the problem is that, and your guest hit this on the nose, is that you don't see it. We look at the ocean, we see this vast ocean, we think it's a resource that's just going to replenish itself constantly, constantly, not realizing that as if you had, I don't know, if you're living in an environment outside and you have a ton of a certain type of a bird or a certain type of animal, and you're noticing that and it's part of your backyard, of your environment, and you see it all the time, and all of a sudden you notice that they're gone, it's something that you recognize and you see. We don't see anything because nobody's, you know, I mean, the amount of people that spend time under the ocean and do diving is probably maybe, if that, 1% of the population.
So you talk to people, Tom.
We don't see it.
When you come up, you talk to people about what you see down there, and are people surprised? Do people get it? You know what you're saying about the what's happening to the ocean?
Well, when I talk to the people that have boats and that spend time on the ocean, it does sink in, because a lot of people that I associate with that have boats are, you know, like to fish. And of course, you know, if you're talking to somebody that's say 50 or older, who are used to fishing years ago when they could just throw the hook in the ocean and come up with whatever fish they were looking for on that particular day, they're aware of the fact that there is a difference. Of course, they're not even aware of the amount of trash that's in the ocean, because, you know, people do throw things overboard, even fishermen. I mean, if there's trash on the bottom of the ocean floor, it's not coming from people that are on land. It's coming from people that are in boats. And I even think that they're, unaware or uncaring. I hate to use that word, but, you know, they don't look at it as a finite resource. They look at it as an infinite resource.
And you've seen a lot more of this, Deborah, I think probably than most of us.
Well, what I would say to Tom is, I mean, he's clearly right. I mean, there's a double problem that he's describing. He's describing the problem of overfishing, and he's describing the problem of dumping. And I guess what I would say is, when you're discussing this with all your friends, tell them to call their congressman and support all the recommendations that are in the Pew Report, because we need to take a greater responsibility for what's out there, for what we can't see.
I mean, one of the principal things is, and this is, we should say this, the Pew Ocean Commission report is the first serious federal government look at the state of the oceans in over 30 years, right?
Yes.
And what do you point to in that as the one most useful recommendation that you would have Tom and others focus in on? Is, I mean, write your congressman and say, yes, all the laws need to be rewritten.
No, support having a National Ocean Policy Act, and support having an act, and also amending our existing laws so that we have an ocean ethic now, so that we will administer our laws for the protection and restoration of our seas, not merely for the extraction of what's in there.
Which is sort of what the Stratton Commission report wanted to do 30 years ago. How do we get our share of the fish?
Treating it as commerce. And then the other part of it is that we have laws that regulate more or less well, depending on the circumstance, public health. We're not just talking about public health, that is our health now. So we aren't really regulating all the nitrogen that goes into the water, because that doesn't directly affect our health. It affects the health of the animals that are living in the sea. That is indirectly going to come back to hurt us, but we need to regulate that now. So I guess I would say we need an ocean ethic that protects and restores our seas.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for your call. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Sonny, who's calling in from Pittsboro, North Carolina. Hi, Sonny.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Good, good. Look, this is a great topic, and me and my wife and children just came back from Long Beach, North Carolina, which is the beach right across from Bald Head Island, and probably had one of the best fishing trips I've ever had with my son and my wife. And the flounder was exceptionally large, which I kind of thought that was key since the guy just mentioned that.
Yeah.
We had a great day. My son actually missed getting a citation. It's the first time he ever went, and he actually missed getting a citation trout in the state of North Carolina, which is 4 pounds by 4 ounces. Having that said, though, I'm very concerned with the amount of trash and litter I see, as I like to call them trash lights, because that seems to be where everybody thinks they can dispose of their cigarette butts or anything else they have loose laying around their vehicle. On the ground, where do they think that goes? And North Carolina has really done a lot with the river, you know, River Keepers Association, the Trout's Unlimited, Coastal Carolina Fishing Association, things of that nature, to help improve pickup days of picking up this big trash. That's great, and we're doing a better job. I can see a difference, even though I still see a lot of trash out there, and it's very disheartening to be out there fishing, you know, in the salt marshes and catching my son's first trout and having a great time and see 20 empty Coke, Pepsi bottles floating around. And
Sonny, did your boy notice the trash as well?
That's what I was getting at. That's the thing that upset me more than anything and brought it to realization was that he mentioned it, you know, what's that floating over there? And I told him it was a bottle. And he said, well, this isn't a trash can. And I said, no, son, but some people treat it that way. And, of course, you know, it's disheartening because a seven-year-old child recognizes the need to pick up your trash and take care of this beautiful piece of the world that we can't replace. People just don't realize how critical it is to have a live, living, well-working, managing oyster bed unless you live in the Chesapeake Bay Area. And God knows, someone please talk to those people. They'll tell you. The oysters there used to be able to clear the water, and I think it was a 62-hour cycle. Now it can't clear the water in like a two-year period. I mean, it's
In a year?
I mean, it's unreal how much it's gone from. I mean, it's just been overdeveloped. The oysters have been taken, undersized oysters. People go in there and destroy the beds by docking and dropping anchors on top of them. And it's the same thing here in North Carolina. We've got to get control. Well, not just North Carolina. It's the same way in America. We've got to get control of our estuaries and what's coming downstream, because what starts up the upstream is going to end up downstream. And then on top of that, you've got to respect and love the environment that you're in, because if you don't take care of it today, you know, my son may not have the opportunity I had to take his seven-year-old son one day out there and catch fish.
And somehow, Deborah, it's a matter of making that connection between what's upstream and what's downstream that nobody's really forced anyone to think about.
No, and it's really hard because it's so dark at the end of the, you know, at the end. And the Chesapeake Bay, I think, is a really, really good example. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation used to just have, I think, you know, a couple thousand people working. Now it's more than 100,000 people, and people are working really, really hard down there. They're trying to rebuild the oyster beds. They're replanting the seagrasses. They have a big instruction on their website for how to build a rain barrel to stop the runoff from your yard from going in. And they measure the health of the Chesapeake Bay by what they perceive it was when John Smith first arrived. And so they would give that rating 100. It's now down to 27, and they're working really, really hard, but they haven't been able to improve it yet.
All right. Tom, thank you for, or rather, Sonny, thanks for that call. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, what should the national ocean policy be? What would you be willing to do to make it come about? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by New England.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Deborah Kramer's with me. She's author of a book called Great Waters, An Atlantic Passage. And Deborah, just reflecting back on what Sonny was saying about taking his boy down to catch fish, and I guess we should consider him lucky that they were catching fish. A lot of people aren't. I was thinking that it's a terrific example of what the Pew Commission calls ocean literacy. Somehow finding a way of getting all that anecdotal stuff that's so powerful and making it a part of what the country thinks about, not just the folks who look at the ocean from their, you know, beachfront home or who have the privilege of walking on the beach, but everybody. And I don't know how you do that.
Well, one way that you do it is you probably change the way you teach science in high school.
Give me an example.
You can go through high school taking biology, chemistry, mm-hmm. and physics, and never really understanding where the air you breathe comes from or where the water goes when you turn on the faucet. And I know this because I speak to a lot of school groups, and I ask them these questions, and they don't know the answers. And that's how sort of disconnected we are from our environment now.
So if I was to ask you to give us an example of this, could you use the oysters or Chesapeake Bay as an example of something
the oysters in Chesapeake Bay are really interesting because what the last caller was saying and what Nancy was talking about is certainly true. The oysters in the Chesapeake Bay used to filter all the water in the bay, could filter an equivalent amount of water in the bay in 3 days. Now it would take what's left there a year. And restoring oysters is a tricky thing because you want to put baby oysters in the bay, but they won't grow unless the water is clean. And The water can't be clean until we stop putting so much nitrogen in it. And the rain closures in my house, near my house, just say rain closure. They don't say why. We need to learn why. And I think schools are a really good place to teach that because kids are a captive audience. We don't regulate the nitrogen coming out of our cars. All those SUVs we're driving put more nitrogen into the air because they're regulated as trucks.
I always thought of nitrogen as just mainly from fertilizers as sort of the principal.
There's a study that just came out about the degradation of estuaries in the Northeast, and certainly what's going down the Mississippi River, a lot of that problem is fertilizer. Here in the Northeast where we live, a big chunk of it is from airborne emissions, that is coal-fired power plants, right, and our cars. And the other big chunk of it comes from our sewage treatment plants.
Can you get nitrogen out of the water in a proper sewage treatment plant?
Yes, we certainly can. We just have to make the decision that that's what we want to do.
And that costs money.
Yes.
A lot of money?
Yes.
And that's the wall that you keep hitting, because I read a couple of times this phrase that I've heard before, that the ocean has no constituency, that the ocean doesn't have, you know, people who speak for it. There are those who do, and articulately, but it has been a small constituency.
Because people don't understand what it is we're receiving. And if all of us could learn that it's the air we breathe, we would care a lot.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Sumter, South Carolina. David's joining us. Hi, David.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My point is that our fish are disappearing. There's too much fishing going on, commercial fishing. Our largest fish are going or they're gone. The middle-sized fish, which feed those largest fish, are being pressured. Fish are prolific breeders, and in a period of time, they could replenish. It's hard to do, but with a moratorium on fishing of about 7 years, fish stocks might be able to replenish.
You're saying tie up every fishing boat for 7 years?
In the world. It's impossible, but, you know, if you could do that, you could manage your fish then. You could harvest more than you can now, and you can harvest it forever. You'd have to manage the world's fishing thing, and it'd have to be legislated through the world. I mean, it's not just my choice. I'd be willing to give up fish for 7 years, but I'm, you know, an individual choice isn't enough.
Is it realistic, Deborah, the idea of just sort of slamming the door shut on fishing, commercial fishing, as a way of at least allowing the cod and the flounder and some of the ones that are in real trouble to come back?
Let's go back just a second first to talk about what can be done. I think David was talking about the fish that are gone. I think it's a really good thing to point that out. We have also had one incredible success story up in New England by shutting down a large portion of George's Bank to protect the cod and the flounder that he's talking about. We also prevented scallop dredges from going in there in order to protect the ground fish.
Is this what we call a marine reserve?
Well, this was not an official marine reserve.
Right.
But it was the equivalent of one. And I think we closed those scallop beds in about 1994. At that time, we were taking out every year 70% of the scallops that were in there, and we were getting about 40, 50 scallops to a pound. When those beds were reopened, there were more scallops there than any scientist had ever seen or read about. So the sea has an amazing ability to restore itself.
So David's idea is a good one, but rather than something unrealistic, which is, you know, shutting down an entire industry, you're saying that you can choose parts of the ocean and say, let's leave that alone. Let them rebuild there. I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying.
What I'm saying is there's a tremendous capacity to rebuild our fisheries. And my latest understanding of this is that rather than shutting everything down, what we need to do, at least up in New England, is reduce it by another 40%. Now, that will put some people out of business. It won't put everybody out of business. But the tremendous return for that in the long run is a real important consideration. For all these years, what we've had is And we totally have the capability of doing this. Our scientists have been telling us what to do for years. We just haven't been paying any attention.
Well, or disregarding what they say because of the politics of it. I mean,
right,
you're putting
right.
real people in of jobs for something that's...
Right, but this is a public trust. And David and Sonny and Tom and all the people who have been calling understand that. But where is everybody when the Fisheries Management Council makes those decisions? Nobody's there.
That's when people need to stand up and speak for that kind of scientific advice. Is that what you're saying?
And to say we want our public trust protected. We don't want it emptied in this generation.
All right, David, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Orleans, Massachusetts now. Dana's on the line. Hi, Dana.
Hi, good morning. A new ethic that was mentioned earlier, a new ocean ethic. And with that in mind, I'd like to go back to what I consider first principles, and that is that since this involves, you know, inland communities as well as, coastal communities, mm-hmm. I really feel humankind as a species needs, at least in the West, and those are the only people I'm really familiar with, the civilization I live in, is that we need to stop thinking of land and sea as commodities to be exploited, you know, and to see nature as sacred with its own intrinsic value, even if we do sustain life from it ourselves. I mean, ideally, I'd prefer that we all be vegetarians, but that's sort of beside the point right now.
Do you see anything either in the education system, Dana, or just in conversations that you have with friends where you're, you know, getting a sense that the people's view about the land and the ocean as a place for humans to take things from is changing?
No, I don't see a change at all. Matter of fact, I see it all reinforced, especially by, you know, the whole market ideology that, you know, everything is there for the taking. And yes, okay, I mean, I'm not saying everybody should, I would, you know, ideally, I know we're not going to all put down our fishing rods and tie up our fishing boats and, you know, but, I mean, people still talk as if we're entitled to all of it, you know, free and clear. And if we don't realize, I think we should just see ourselves as a part of it. And what we do to it, we have to account for in some way. So, I mean, Native Americans, who probably really valued the land more than we do as a sacred trust rather than a commodity, if I'm my history's right, even they took fish and everything, but they saw themselves as part of a continuum. We don't see ourselves that way in the West. We see nature as below us, and it's ours for the taking. It's like our condominium, and we're free to manipulate it and you know, sell it and buy it as we choose. And I think that reflects in a lot of my friends' conversations. Yes, you know, they talk about, well, we're the fishermen. I mean, a lot of fishermen in this community, you know, we tend to romanticize them, you know, the fishermen. And, you know, they got to make a living. I don't begrudge them that. But, you know, there's a lot of practices in fishing and a lot of real estate development practices that were mentioned earlier that are just really killing the ocean. I mean, because...
All right, Dana, let me stop you there. I want to let Deborah in here for just a minute. Deborah.
Well, Dana, you raise a lot of really, really good points. The first about the vegetarian aspects of this. Some people are vegetarians, but a lot of people really don't need to go that far. There's plenty of information out now about which fish are fished sustainably and which ones aren't. And you can find out about that from the National Audubon Society, the Ocean Conservancy, any of those places. And you can choose what kind of fish you eat. You can go into a store and
you can... remind me after the program, we'll get those websites from you. We'll put a link to them on our website.
Okay. You can go into a fish store, and I can do this in Gloucester, and I can see the farm-raised salmon in one bin and the wild salmon, which is okay to eat from the Pacific coast, in another, and I can choose to buy the wild salmon. I can choose not to eat farm-raised salmon. Second thing, in terms of the sacred trust that he was talking about, I think this is what the Pew Commission is calling for, but I think it's really important not to separate the sacred and the secular, because this is what we've done all along. We see something sacred out there, like we have these marine sanctuaries that are useless. And the reason is that the boundaries are porous, and how we live our daily life is filtering into those places and changing it. So it's not just fishermen. It's all of us.
The other thing, too, that I wanted to ask you about, Deborah, is the way that we measure the health of the ocean, because it struck me as I was going through the number of studies that we still use as a yardstick what we lose as human beings, that you know, the codfish aren't as plentiful, and so we can't eat cod as cheaply as we used to, and that is a measure of the sickness of the ocean. But you spend enough time on the ocean to see a little bit beyond just, you know, how we measure it for what its usefulness is to us. Am I making any sense here?
Oh, yes, you are. But in this kind of society, that is the way people look at things. But it isn't just, you know, the usefulness of cod. When you take out top predators, you cause this cascade of so many other things, so that you take out the top predators on a coral reef, and then all of a sudden the reef can't grow anymore. And we lose much more than the grouper that were on the reef that we like to eat, but we lose an entire ecosystem. And some people think we can get along without everybody else, but I don't think that's true. I mean, we need to all be here together.
The one thing that I found, the thing that I thought about in looking at your book, that was the biggest hurdle to cross, the biggest piece of persuasion that you have to do, is you describe the Atlantic as a small and intimate place. And if you could get more people to believe that, boy, that I think that would make a difference, don't you?
It would make all the difference in the world, and that's why so much of this book is about making those connections for people. So I talk about sea turtles, and they come up on a beach for just one night, two nights, and we see them on the beach, and then they leave. And so we try to protect the beach for these nesting turtles, but that's not the only place they live. They live in the Gulf Stream, where they're choking on plastic, and they spend their adolescence out in the Mediterranean. And over again, I try to pull all the pieces together so we can see it as one coherent place.
Deborah, thanks so much for coming in. Deborah Kramer.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Deborah Kramer is author of Great Waters and Atlantic Passage. Earlier in the program, we talked with Nancy Schilling. She's founder of Friends of the Rivers. That's a conservation organization, Spring Island, South Carolina. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Worcester Academy, offering family-friendly 5-day plus boarding.